A unified vision.
Everything has to change once in a while. When we came, we had in mind a different subject in lieu of the wedding and the festival of love that weddings always bring. We were going to talk about the concept of love as new creatures. But the subject that Brother Lamel chose so beautifully covered so many of the same areas that we thought we would vary a little bit from it. One of the points we particularly appreciated in Brother Ed's remarks was that the unity that holds the Lord's people together is, above all, a unity of vision. It's a unity of seeing a common truth and appreciating that truth and letting that truth motivate in a common way. So frequently, as we get together and discuss details of the vision, we do find areas of disagreement, areas where one holds one opinion, one holds another opinion. But it doesn't change the overall vision. It's the overall vision that is so unified. And it's going to be a little area of that overall vision that we're going to look at today. Some of you will recognize the remarks from here on as under a different title. I gave it last week in Jersey City, on the banks of the Hiddekel. Just a portion of the vision that we see of the days that lie ahead of us. I would like you to consider the prophet Daniel. Consider Daniel kidnapped at 13 years of age, taken to a country far from his home, quickly rising through the overruling of providences and through his natural talents to the very pinnacles of political power. For some 89 years in the civil service of the government of Babylon. Consider Daniel, who at all of these years in the public service in the highest ranks of that ministry, never forgot his people. Never forgot his true goals. Three times a day, morning, noon, and night, praying with his face toward Jerusalem. Now consider Daniel, age 89 years in public service, age 102. Finally, the government that had refrained him from going back to his homeland is overthrown. The Medes and the Persians come in. And Daniel is permitted to move. But not back to Israel. 450 miles further east, farther from his goal of returning to his people, to the desert capital of Persepolis. Now consider Daniel 2 years later, age 104. The time of the Passover has come. And Daniel, for some reason, journeys some 180 miles from Persepolis to the banks of the Tigris River. We know not why. Perhaps it was his vacation. Perhaps he arranged to be there in government business. But he journeys there, and that's where we find Daniel in the 10th chapter of his prophecy, verse 4. And in the 24th day of the first month, as I was by the side of the great river, which is Hiddekel. The Hiddekel, or as we would know it today, the Tigris, was an area where Daniel, in this vision, has a number of experiences and sees a number of visions. First, there is the experience of the 21-day delay in the answer to his prayer. For 21 days, centered around the Passover, Daniel has prayed for an answer to one simple question, a question that many of you have prayed. How long? How long, O Lord? And after 21 days, the angel finally comes to him and said, I came immediately, but I was restrained. It wasn't until Michael came to help me that I could come and give you the answer. And then he gives the answer in two successive visions. The 11th chapter of Daniel, covering a panorama of Earth's history from the days of Daniel up to the Napoleonic era, the early 1800s, the late 1700s, 1799, time of the end. And then the 12th chapter, refining the answer to the question in the prophecy of the 1260, the 1290, and the 1335 days. These visions, we think, are significant that they were at the banks of the Hiddekel. Why the banks of the Hiddekel? Why did Daniel go there to receive these visions? for the simple reason it was as far as he could go. He wanted to go all the way. He wanted to return with his people to Israel. But the Hiddekel was a tremendous barrier, a river to be forded. And even if he had forded the river, what then? There were still two more rivers to ford, the even greater Euphrates, and just before reaching the homeland, the Jordan itself. So he was not permitted to return. But he is given this vision, a vision of the return of his people. And that vision, as you know, is typical. It's typical of the return of the church from antitypical Babylon. But that's only partial. It's more than that. It's typical of the return of natural Israel to their homeland eventually, in the kingdom for which we pray, thy kingdom come. But it's more than that. In its largest sense, the return of the Jews from Babylon is typical of the return of all mankind from sin and death. That's the real picture. That's the large picture. The picture that we all so much appreciate. If we notice the geography of the curse of Adam and Eve, we can further appreciate this picture. In Genesis, the second chapter, verses 10 to 14, we are told that the land of Eden was at the headwaters of four rivers, including the Tigris and the Euphrates. In other words, it's up in the area that today would be southern Turkey, up in the mountains of that area, northern Syria, in that general area. Then in Genesis, the second chapter, the eighth verse, we're told that within that land, the garden was planted in the east, in the eastern part of the land. It's implied further in Genesis 3:24 that when Adam and Eve were driven out of the garden, they were driven further east. And then again in Genesis 4:16, when Cain slew Abel, he was driven still further east to the land of Nod, always to the eastward. If you take that land and you go east, you find yourself into what is today the northern part of the land of Iran. That time, the land of Persia. Well, that was the land of the curse. And here is the return from the Medo-Persian Empire that Daniel is forecasting. And he said, we want to come back. All mankind wants to return from the land of sin and death to that kingdom that will be upon this world. But as you just think about it, not from a biblical standpoint. Think about the concept of a biblical kingdom from just a philosophical, a politically philosophical standpoint. You'll notice that there are two major barriers to that kingdom being established. And when you add the biblical perspective, there's three. From the political standpoint, there is the entrenched power of present earthly governments. As long as these governments hold power, there is no room for a kingdom. The two are in opposition. The earth cannot bear both types of government. But even if you were to remove the power of earthly government, without removing the shell of the government itself, you would still have the same problem. The philosopher Machiavelli in The Prince recognizes this principle. He says that any government overtaking another government, unless it removes all vestiges of the former government, cannot establish a new government. You notice this historically today in the coups that take place in the Third World particularly, that when a coup takes place, when the former dictator escapes to another country, all he does is form a government in exile to someday return and reestablish himself. And so the successful coup maker must kill, must remove, must take away all possibility of the reformation of a new government. And this is going to be true with the establishment of God's kingdom. Not only will there be the removal of power, but the removal of the vestiges of the government itself. That's perhaps beautifully shown in Revelation, the 18th chapter, where in the early part of the chapter, you have, speaking of Babylon, antitypical Babylon, the mystical church-state systems that have ruled the world. Babylon is fallen, but is not fallen physically. It has fallen from the concept of power. It has fallen from spiritual favor. And it's not until the end of the chapter that Babylon is taken up like a mighty millstone and thrown into the sea, and you come to its physical destruction. And so that distinction must be made between the fall from power and the fall from entity of the governments. But of course, religiously, the greater barrier that must be removed before that kingdom can come is the barrier of sin and death. The curse, the death sentence must be removed before there can be any return to life and prosperity upon this earth. Now let's take this concept of these three barriers and let's go back to our picture of Daniel by the banks of the Hiddekel praying for this return. In effect, Daniel is facing three barriers also for the return. The Hiddekel or Tigris, the Euphrates, and the Jordan. You know, rivers in the Bible picture many things. Because rivers are a carrier for water, they often picture streams of truth, as in Psalm 46:4. Other places, because rivers form the economic base for a city, they represent peoples, as in Revelation 16:12. When crossed Jishad as the Jordan, they represent the death sentence, as in Joshua 3:16 and 17. But always, rivers represent a barrier. That which prohibits movement. You're before the days of bridges. You don't have tunnels. You have to ford the streams. And a deep river, particularly at harvest time, and this picture, by the way, around Nisan, around Passover, is at harvest time, the river banks are flooded. The waters are wide. The waters are deep. And these represent mighty barriers to be crossed, as in Exodus 14:16. The destination is typical. Canaan. Canaan is the promised land. Canaan is the land of the covenant. Canaan is the kingdom. Let's go then and look at these three rivers and notice scripturally how these rivers are crossed and see how they represent, in scripture prophesied, this unified vision that we all can see of what must transpire from the days of sin and evil to the establishment of the kingdom. The river Hiddekel. Let's take that one first. You know, there's a river that we often talk about prophetically, but we don't often define geographically. It's in the 12th chapter of Daniel, verses 5 to 7. Daniel 12, 5 to 7. And I, Daniel, looked, and behold, there stood other two, the one on this side of the bank of the river, and the other on that side of the bank of the river. And one said to the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, how long? There's that question. Daniel's question, Israel's question, your question and my question. How long shall it be till the end of these wonders? And I heard the man clothed in linen which sat upon the waters of the river. And he said, and he held up his right hand and his left to heaven and swear by him that liveth forever, that it shall be for a time, times and a half, when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people. All these things shall be finished. You know, we look at that river and we don't really identify it. But you go back in context. That's what Daniel 10:4 is all about. Daniel 10:4 tells you what river it is. It's the Hiddekel. That's where he sees this vision. It's by the Tigris where he sees this crossing. And the crossing of this river is what Daniel wants to know. When can I go across? How long before I can top this river, go across the next one, go all the way, and go back to Israel? And he said, I'm sorry, you're going to have to wait for time, times, and half a time. A very enigmatic phraseology. A phraseology that's so general that if that was all you had to go by, you probably never could figure out what it meant. Fortunately, in the book of Revelation, when you read chapters 11, 12, 13, you notice that this same period, time, times, and half a time, is also called 42 months or 1260 days. And so you've got the riddle solved for you. The Bible solves its own riddle. And you've got a period of 1,260 days or prophetically 1,260 years. We're not going to spend a lot of time identifying that. You've gone through the proofs of that yourself in your own studies. You've read it in the volumes. You've seen the points how from the establishment of the power of the church-state systems in 539 until the end of the Napoleonic era, when the Pope himself is taken prisoner, and you have a complete breaking of the church-state structure, was a period of 1,260 years. So that 1799 becomes emblematic of the crossing of the Tigris. That is when the Tigris is crossed. That is when that barrier of church-state government, that barrier of entrenched power, was finally breached. You know, leading up to this was Daniel 11. Daniel 11 was the panorama of history. And there's a teaser in Daniel 11. It's thrown in about five times. You go along, and it says, but the end is not yet. Until the time of the end. Until the time of the end. And that little teaser just kept dropping in. As though that's the expectation of what Daniel 11 is all about. When you get to the end of Daniel 11, you're at the time of the end. That's the vision that he's heading for. Then he says, at that time, Michael would stand up. The great prince was standing for the children of thy people. And there should be a time of trouble such as never was. And thy people would be delivered. In a very real sense, at the beginning of the time of the end, there was the pre-movement toward the whole bringing about of present prophetic conditions. The Napoleonic era is directly connected historically to the French Revolution. The two are just totally tied together. And the French Revolution, we believe, biblically, is well predicted in the prophecies of the great earthquake of Revelation 6, 12 to 17, which is noted as the great day of God's wrath. And the great earthquake of Revelation 11, 13, which takes place in the sixth trumpet when the tenth part, France, of the nations fell. So that the French Revolution and the Napoleonic era are connected with this one thing. The fall of governmental power. That's what the French Revolution was all about. It was a rising of the populace. It was a rising of the popular people. We no longer want dictatorial heredity heads of state over us. No longer shall we be ruled by a constant handing down of power of autocrats. No, it didn't accomplish it in the night. But it started a wave that has kept on going, building, 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 until finally the First World War almost totally toppled the whole concept of the divine right of kings. But that wave began to topple way back in the French Revolution. That's why the time of the end starts there. It is the crossing of that first barrier of getting across the concept of political power where the entrenched governments of ages could hold back authoritatively any progress toward a spiritual government. There needed to be pre-time between this, the time of preparation, and the Lord's return that would bring about the final fall of these governments. Interestingly enough, though, this river Hiddekel, or Tigris, is not only connected with the concept of trouble. It is connected with the concept of truth. There are two ways, and there were two outpourings of truth at that time in the 1790s that were tremendously important. You know, one of the, in fact, the basic prophecy in the whole Bible upon which the 1260 days comes from is not this prophecy. It comes before this. Remember Elijah? How in the days of Elijah he prayed that there be no rain? And for time, times, and half a time. For 3.5 years there was no rain upon the land. And then you remember at the end of that, how he goes to the top of Mount Carmel and brings all the priests of Baal. And he said, now let's find out whose God is more powerful. And all the priests of Baal try to get their God to consume their sacrifice with fire. And Elijah did the opposite. He just poured water on his sacrifice. And it was the one that was consumed. And in the aftermath, the priests of Baal were killed. And Elijah, in his thrill, eventually runs ahead of the chariot all the way to Samaria. But he doesn't start out running. First, he waits. He waits to be sure that his prediction is true. He waits, and seven times he sends a servant up. Any sign of rain? Six times the servant comes back. No, no, no sign of rain. And I imagine by that time he's getting a little worried because his whole thing was dependent upon the rain coming. And finally, the seventh time, the servant comes back. Well, I see a cloud about the size of a man's hand. He said, run, it's going to rain. They ran, and before they got down the mountain, it was pouring. It was that sure of the rain. That outpouring from a cloud just the size of a man's hand was representative of a flood of spiritual truth that came at the end of 1260 days. And I think it's significant that it was the size of a man's hand. Not a woman's, I don't mean that. A man's as opposed to an angel's hand or a big cloud. That it represented truths, spiritual truths from the heavens that will be delivered by the hand of man. It represented the outpouring of the Bible in the common languages as it was spread through the Bible societies of 1802, 1803, 1804, and from there there was a constant streaming of the Bible message. This, we believe, is the water of truth, spiritual truth, that came at that time. But there was another river of truth, directly connected with the river in Daniel 12. And it's in Revelation 12. The chapter is the same. The book is different. The last book in Revelation, and we want to go to the end of the 12th chapter of Revelation. Starting in verse 13. And when the dragon saw that he was cast into the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. And the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, that she might into her place where she is nourished for a time, times and half a time. Notice, same period. That same period of 1260 days from the face of the serpent. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a river of flood after the woman and swallowed, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out. If you go back to that era, you'll notice that there was another outpouring of tremendous truths that did not come from religious people, that came from totally non-religious people. Truths of the oppressiveness of the present governments at that time. Truths of the rights of man. Truths that were spread by the likes of Robespierre and of Voltaire and of Thomas Paine. These truths were issued forth not for the purpose of encouraging Bible study. These were not religious truths at all. These were truths that, as it were cast forth with the hope that people would have a backlash and say, we will not have the anarchy that these writers are predicting. We would prefer to have still the autocracy of the old governments. But it said the earth would have none of it. It opened her mouth and said, we're ready for these truths. And a whole new age set in. An age of people clamoring for their rights. A precursor to the very times we're living in which there was a clamoring of every man for his rights upon the earth. That all goes back to the same period of time. These two floods of parallel truth, one from the heavens, the Bibles, the other from the dragon, the political concepts of the rights of man, both having one effect, taking away the authority of the present governments that were then upon the earth. But removing the governments, the authority of the governments, has in no wise removed the governments. And we see the governments very still entrenched upon this earth. But we don't see them with the autocratic powers of 200 years ago. We don't see them able as single despots, by and large, to call the shots, as they called the shots in the 16th, 17th, and 1800s. Now we find that they have to deal with people. They got to deal with their own stay in office by elections. They've got to deal with parliaments. They've got to deal with congresses. They've got to deal with more of a popular form of government. But they're still there. There still has to be the removal of the governments themselves. And that's what the second barrier is all about. The Euphrates is crossed in Revelation chapter 16, verse 12. In the picture of the sixth plague. And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. He said, if you want the kings of the east to come,
and the east, in many translations, is more properly rendered sunrising. The kings of the sunrising, the kings that come with the sun of righteousness beginning to dawn, the church accomplishing its millennial age work. So that can't happen until you dry up the Euphrates, until you remove the political systems themselves that are upon the earth. The implication in the 16th chapter of Revelation, not very strong here, but implied, is that at that time, the church is fully complete. This is dried up so that the kings of the east can return, can come. There is a returning concept of the kings of the east, which implies a completion of that. Now, that's further implied in the Lord's great prophecy in Matthew 24, verse 22, where he said there'd be a time of trouble. He said that would have the ability to destroy all human flesh, unless those days be shortened. But for the elect's sake, through the means of the church, those days would be shortened. Well, certainly the church cannot shorten those days on the side of the veil. The only way the church would have that authority would be if they were complete with her Lord beyond. But you notice how this action of the church to come back after this and to restore mankind is hindered by the occupancy of the earth of present governments. Matthew 12 says that. That two cannot be there at the same time. They're going to be in total conflict. So the one has to be removed in preparation for the other. You know, there's a scripture, it doesn't relate to this at all, but the principle covers it so well. It's in 2 Thessalonians 2:7. It talks about the early church, and it says that the man of sin was already working. And he said, eventually, he that now letteth will let. It could not be demonstrated as the man of sin. As long as there was a present pagan government, the iniquity could not be shown. Well, here there's a hinderer. As long as that which now hinders, and the hinderer here is present governments are there, you cannot have the full establishment of the millennial government. The preparation of the kings of the east through this crossing the Euphrates has in itself a preparation. Is it pre-preparation for it? We'd like to look at it briefly. It's in Revelation, the 9th chapter, where you find the Euphrates mentioned, but not crossed as such. Revelation 9, 13 to 15. We're down to the period of the sixth angel, which is the period of the French Revolution. And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for a given hour, day, month, year, to slay the third part of man. Here you have, in the Euphrates, as it were, four forces, four angels. These are loosed. These are loosed to do a work. But he said they can't do the work until the time for which that work is prepared has arrived. These are the same angels you meet in Revelation 7. They're holding back the four winds. They're not permitting these winds to have their full whirlwind effect upon the earth. Until we come to that same point, the church is complete. The saints of God are sealed in their foreheads. Then you have the permission of these winds to blow. Then they can have the full force of anarchy upon the earth. We could put it in other terms. The French Revolution, the sixth trumpet, unloosed the forces, the four angels, that are not permitted their full authority to blow until you come to the Battle of Armageddon at the very end of the age and the church is complete. The crossing of the river Euphrates is pictured in a type in the Bible. Let's spend a few minutes looking at that type. It's found in 2 Chronicles chapter 35, verses 20 to 22. It's a very short passage, and it deals with the literal crossing of the Euphrates by the king of Babylon, one that was opposed by Josiah, king of Israel. Interestingly enough, this battle is called the Battle of Carchemish. Only deserves three verses in the Bible. In history, it's known as one of the most decisive battles of all history. It was probably the crucial battle in the whole development of the Babylonian Empire. But the Bible just touches it very briefly. Second Chronicles 35, 20 to 22. After all this, when Josiah had repaired the temple, Necho king of Egypt came up against Carchemish by Euphrates, and Josiah went out against him. But he sent ambassadors to him, saying, What have I to do with thee, thou king of Judah? I come not against thee this day, but against the house wherewith I have war. For God commanded me to make haste. Forbear thee from meddling with God, who was with me, that he destroy thee not. Nevertheless, Josiah would not turn his face from him, but disguised himself that he might fight with him, and hearkened not unto the words of Necho from the mouth of God, and came to fight in the valley of Megiddo. And there Josiah is killed, and this is a great mourning for Josiah. We're not going to go into detail on this. It's a little bit heavy, perhaps. But let's take a few light observations that are here. First, let's notice that there may be an inclination to feel that Josiah was just totally wrong for getting involved. After all, Necho said, This battle, God told me to go and fight. Don't stand in my way. But you know, when you hear a statement like that, it's always good to ask, Who said it? Necho says, God told me to fight. Who is Necho referring to as God? Necho is not a worshiper of Jehovah God. Necho is a worshiper of Isis and Aten and the gods of Egypt. It's the gods of Egypt that he is claiming as his authority. Secondly, let's notice that in 2 Chronicles 34, 26 to 28, God gives an unconditional promise to Josiah. No conditions established. Let's notice what that promise is. As for the king of Judah, who sent you to inquire of the Lord, so shall you say to him, Thus saith the Lord God of Israel concerning the words which thou hast heard. Because thine heart was tender, and thou didst humble thyself before God, when thou heardest his words against this place and against the inhabitants thereof, and humblest thyself before me, and didst rend thy clothes and weep before me. I have even heard thee, said the Lord. I will gather thee to thy fathers, and thou shalt be gathered to thy grave in peace. Neither shall thine eyes see all the evil that I will bring upon this place and upon the inhabitants of the same. Unconditionally. He doesn't say, Josiah, you do this and you'll die peacefully. He says, send back word, Josiah will die in peace. And then Josiah gets killed at this battle of Carchemish. How can you die in peace in battle? Very simply, if you know the cause you're fighting for is right, if you're sure of that cause, then you can die in peace, feeling that you have done that which you had to do. I always appreciate a statement Brother Foss used to use about Josiah. He said, always consider the three wells in Josiah's life. He began well, he ran well, he ended well. And I think that's a nice summary of the life of Josiah. That it is not here something that Josiah is doing wrongly. Josiah is trying to protect Israel by saving Israel from the impending invasion. He goes up, he is killed in the battle, the Armageddon battle. That again is significant, isn't it? Because it's at the Armageddon battle where you find the crossing of the Euphrates. Here is where the Euphrates is bridged. Just a little sidelight here for those who want to get into the battle. It may appear to some, from the rendering in Kings of the account, that's in 2 Kings 23:29, that Josiah is going to fight against Assyria. But the better translations are he's going to fight with Assyria. He's joining force with Assyria, not Josiah, Necho, against the encroachment of Babylon. So what we're looking at is that there is a great battle connected with this final crossing, the crossing of the Euphrates. A barrier that's got to be crossed, that can only be crossed in the Armageddon conflict at the end of the age. Notice one more thing in Chronicles before we leave this prophecy. When the battle takes place. After Josiah had prepared the temple. The temple preparations were complete. The church is finished at the time of this battle. He gives you a very specific time setting. He has done his reform work. He has completed the church. Now you can have the crossing of the Euphrates and the coming to the final barrier. And that final barrier is the River Jordan. Even after you move all the governments from this earth, even after you would remove all the satanic powers that have prevailed, you cannot have peace to remove the death sentence. The death sentence must be removed. Ransom is so indelibly connected with its antithesis of resurrection. The resurrection cannot take place until ransom has been fully and completely applied. And so in the return, you come to the River Jordan. And that beautiful prophecy that we won't spend time on because our time is progressing, but in Joshua, the third chapter, where you have the final crossing. We do want to notice one thing, though, in the crossing of Jordan, just in closing. In Joshua 3, you've got the crossing dry shod as the people of Israel enter the promised land. But there are two place names that we think are very significant in this crossing. Joshua 3, 16 and 17. That the waters which came down from above stood and rose up from a heap very far, near, King James says from, near the city Adam that is beside Zaratan, and they came down toward the sea of the plain, even the salt sea. They failed and they were cut off, and the people passed over right against Jericho. And the priests that bear the ark of the covenant of the priests that bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the midst of Jordan, and all the Israelites, all of them, passed over dry shod until all the people were passed clean over Jordan. Notice where it stands off at Adam. That's nice in itself, isn't it? How far back is the death curse stopped? Right back at the beginning. Right back at Adam. But then he further identifies Adam. Adam that is beside Zaratan. And this is where it's interesting to let the Bible compare with the Bible. Because today, the map makers haven't found Zaratan. So we wouldn't know where Zaratan is. But the Bible tells us where it is. We have a scripture that gives us the location of Zaratan. It's in 1 Kings, the 4th chapter, and the 12th verse. And it's one of these little verses that I think all of us tend to just read over because it's an area just of a bunch of names together. 1 Kings 4:12. Baana the son of Ahilud, for him pertaineth Taanach and Megiddo and all Bethshan, which is by, and here it says King James Zartana, Zaratan in the Leser, beneath Jezreel, from Bethshan to Abel Meholah. Okay, that's a whole bunch of names. We don't need all those names. All we need to notice is this. Zaratan is right next to Bethshan at the entrance to the Valley of Jezreel. In connection with Megiddo. You go up the Jordan River. If you were to take a canoe up the Jordan or down the Jordan, you would find, as you get south of the Sea of Galilee, that on both sides of the Jordan, there is a canyon, a mountain pass that you go through. And then just as you come through this pass, there is a plain. On the one side of the mountain pass, on the north side, you've got Beth Shan, today is well preserved. On the other side, you've got the mountain of Mahanaim, which is a very tall mountain. Then you come through, and there's this natural valley that crosses perpendicularly across the Jordan River from the country of Jordan today into the country of Israel, the Jezreel Valley. And then immediately the mountains start again. What he's saying is, from the entrance of the battlefield of Megiddo, these are the two things he's tying in. He's tying in Adam all the way back to where the death curtain starts, death sentence starts, to its end, to Zaratan, to the Megiddo Valley. He said, the whole period is covered. It's a blanket coverage of the removal of the death sentence. It is the entire period, and it's a beautiful picture. So in summary, let's put ourselves with Prophet Daniel. Let's put ourselves on the banks of the Hiddekel. Let's put ourselves asking that question that we so much want to know. How long? How long before there can be the return, before that kingdom can be fully established? And taking the perspective of Daniel, let's realize that Daniel was not given, at this point, all the answers in numbers of years. But he said, it can't happen until you cross three barriers. One of those barriers, the first, I'll tell you how long it's going to be. In 1260 years, from a certain very pronounced beginning point, you're going to come to a series of events that are going to cross over the barrier of political power. The French Revolution, Napoleonic era, all of those things connected with it. That won't be the entrance of the kingdom. That'll be the beginning. That'll be the bare beginning. Then you're going to go and you're going to come to another river, the River Euphrates. At that time, the church will be complete. But there will be a crossing of that River Euphrates so the church can accomplish its work upon the earth in the restoration process. And after you cross the Euphrates, you still have a ways to go. You come to the Jordan. And when that death sentence is removed, then you can enter into kingdom conditions. That is a unified vision, brethren. The details may not be. The details may be seen a little differently on this river or that river. But that unity that does draw us together, that unity of that coming kingdom, that coming kingdom will come, be born through the period of trouble. This is one of the things that has historically drawn the Harvest Church together. The beauties of a prophetic vision that goes far beyond the present day into the glories of the coming future.